The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
This is Bloomberg Law with June Grasso from Bloomberg Radio.
Alan Weisselberg, the former CFO of the Trump Organization, is going back to jail. The 76-year-old pleaded guilty to felony perjury charges, just the latest twist in his legal saga, one where he's always remained loyal to Trump. Manhattan prosecutors have given him a deal for lying on the stand at Trump's civil fraud trial and for lying in deposition testimony. Weisselberg was facing five counts of first-degree perjury, a felony punishable by as many as 7 years in prison. But under the plea deal, he'll be sentenced to 5 months in jail and doesn't have to cooperate with prosecutors against his former boss. Joining me is Bloomberg legal reporter Patricia Hurtado. Why are they giving Weisselberg a deal? He perjured himself several times in depositions and on the stand, and he's not testifying against Trump in the hush money case.
Well, the prosecutor said yesterday in court they were giving him credit for basically his age. He's going to be 77. He's 76 right now. The fact that he'd already done prison time once before, as well as his willingness to plead guilty and admit responsibility, was a reason to give him credit. So they basically gave him a discount. He had faced five felony counts of perjury, and they gave him credit, and they only made him plead guilty to two.
Yeah, so why? He's never fully cooperated with prosecutors against Trump. And with this perjury at the trial, he's also violated his probation after serving time for another deal he'd made with prosecutors over dodging taxes. So why give him another deal when he's not giving them anything?
It's hard to divine why they decided to give him a break. Possibly is because of the fact that, you know, he is going to be 77 years old when he goes to serve 5 months in prison now. Maybe they've decided they've got to cut their losses and go on and prosecute other people related to the Trump Organization, like Donald Trump. I was also advised, sources tell me, neither side intends to use him as a witness, and his plea deal was very specific about that. It didn't make any mention, as it did last time he pled guilty, that he was not going to be expected to testify as part of the terms of his plea deal. And his lawyer basically said he looks forward to moving on with his life.
And he's not going to testify, even though Michael Cohen says that he was a part of that hush money scheme?
Well, you could understand why the prosecutors wouldn't want to call him at all, because, I mean, what kind of credibility does a guy have that has pled guilty and admitted to not only tax fraud charges, I think it was 15 counts of tax fraud that he pled guilty to in 2022, and now he faces two more felony counts. So that's like 17 felonies he pled guilty to, including two perjury counts. I think what's good about this guilty plea from the prosecutor's perspective is if the defense tries to attack or assail Michael Cohen's credibility as a twice convicted perjurer, as they have been alleging and confronting him with whenever he's shown up, as he did when he testified at the state attorney general's trial as a witness, they can turn around and use Ellen Weisselberg's admissions of he also committed fraud on Donald Trump's behalf.
Well, I suppose jurors have believed cooperators with worse records. Tell us what Weisselberg lied about under oath.
Well, there were five counts of perjury that he admitted to committing, and he pled guilty and took responsibility for two of those. So the perjurious statements include the fact that he lied when questioned under oath in depositions on three occasions with the New York Attorney General Letitia James's office. And I believe Letitia James was also one of the people questioning him those days, and lied about the size of Donald Trump's triplex apartment at Trump Tower. Alan Weisselberg claimed that it was 30,000 square feet instead of the actual one-third, which is just over 10,000 square feet. He also lied repeatedly in other depositions about what statements of financial condition claimed on the size of Trump Tower triplex, as well as other assets, and the processes and what they told Forbes magazine or didn't tell Forbes magazine. And he also lied when he testified on behalf of Donald Trump in October of last year at the trial.
Whenever it's between the law and Trump, he chooses Trump. And I wonder how much of this has to do with his $2 million severance package. And are they still paying his legal bills?
I understood. I did a story last March in which his former lawyers were forced to get off the case unless they were going to deflect any prosecution or any problems for Trump. So they were viewed as disloyal, his prior two criminal defense lawyers, and they were forced off the case because the Trump organization and the Trump family wasn't going to pay his legal bills any longer. Now, regarding, he did get a $2 million severance package from the Trump org, and some people have said that's 2 million reasons to protect Donald Trump. In this case, it came out that he only got paid $1 million because it was being paid in tranches by the Trump organization. So he had only been paid $1 million as of October of last year when he testified. And he was also going to cough up $1 million in fines as part of the New York AG verdict that the judge imposed in February.
And the severance package requires him not to cooperate with any law enforcement investigation unless legally required to. And Judge Engoron wrote, the Trump organization keeps him on a short leash, and it shows. Did the judge completely discredit Weisselberg's testimony at the civil fraud trial?
He did, in his opinion, in his verdict that he issued, that basically anything that Alan Weisselberg said, and he testified on the stand for several hours on behalf of Donald Trump as a star defense witness, that he was not credible and should be discounted.
Did he even testify against Trump in the criminal tax fraud trial against the Trump organization?
He didn't actually testify against Donald Trump in the tax fraud case before Judge Mershon, who's now presiding over Donald Trump's criminal case. The agreement he had was not a cooperation agreement. It was just that he agreed to testify, but he had to testify truthfully. He basically was very careful in his testimony, and Mershon later said to him when he sentenced him in January 2023 that he was very concerned with some of Weisselberg's testimony, and if he'd known how he was going to behave and what he was going to testify to on the stand at the tax fraud trial, he would have not agreed to give him that break, which the judge had agreed to, of 5 months in prison, which ended up being a very minimal sentence.
Let's talk a little bit about the hush money case that's coming up. That's coming up pretty quickly.
Well, the case that the Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg has made is that Trump did what was called a catch-and-kill scheme, engaged in just as he was running for president in 2016. There were stories out there, including salacious stories, that he'd had sex with the Stormy Daniels, an adult film actress, and he wanted to kill the story. So he basically brokered a deal through intermediaries like his lawyer, his personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, to buy the story from being published from any National Enquirer or any publication that would write about these salacious allegations and bury the news so that it wouldn't come out and it would help his chances of getting elected. Alvin Bragg is now calling it not a hush money case, but actually an election interference case.
I know. I noticed that difference. And is the point to make the case seem more important? Because, you know, the case has been put down as the worst of the criminal cases against Trump. So is he trying to make it something different?
I mean, some people say it's so tawdry. The allegations involve a porn star. There are also other allegations that Alvin Bragg wants to include in the evidence, which are two other instances prior to the election, maybe years before, including that he had had sex with a Playboy model, Karen McDougal, and also that he had bought a catch-and-kill story and buried involving a Trump doorman who had some salacious allegations against Trump. So Alvin Bragg is defending his case, that it's a valid case, that nobody is above the law, including Donald Trump. I mean, the allegations are pretty serious, including that there were checks cut and written to Michael Cohen to reimburse Michael Cohen for making these payments, and that, you know, Trump did them while he was in the White House. so that these canceled checks include Donald Trump at the White House writing out checks, fabricating a pretextual reason of why the checks were being signed, that it wasn't hush money, it was for legal expenses. So there goes the allegation that Trump was falsifying business records. So it sounds like, you know, it's a business crime. Everybody gets accused. Other people who commit these crimes get prosecuted. So why should Donald Trump be different?
I understand that the defense is arguing that Bragg shouldn't be allowed to argue election interference. Has the judge decided?
No. There's many, many things the judge is being asked to decide, including, you know, limiting what kind of evidence gets before the jury. The DA is arguing that Trump should be basically gagged from speaking about the jurors and mention them by name. I understand that there's no proviso under New York state law for jurors to be anonymous. And the federal cases that were the E. Jean Carroll defamation case and sexual assault case, the two federal trials that we just had last year and then in January, both juries were anonymous. But there's no provision for that under state law. And the DA has argued and worried aloud that some people or some Trump followers could get the names of these potential jurors and then release them to the world. And then how could these people operate in kind of secrecy of doing their job as jurors?
It's really reminiscent of a mob trial because you don't hear these kinds of concerns from prosecutors in any other cases. So jury selection starts March 25th. Any idea how long it might take to get a jury?
I've heard estimations of at least 2 weeks and maybe longer. And if we had a controversial case with a high-profile defendant, and it was Harvey Weinstein, who lived in Manhattan, and he was the Hollywood mogul accused of sexually assaulting these women. And that trial, I went back and looked, and it was 10 days of jury selection.
Because the lawyers in New York get to ask questions. It's
right.
Not like the federal system where the judge asks the questions and it moves along quicker.
Yeah, and there's some discussion, and I don't know if it's been decided yet. There was some request by the DA to have people fill in a jury questionnaire, and it sounded like the judge was shying away from actually agreeing to that. So the jury questionnaire would sort of pre-screen people ahead of time. And I think what the judge basically told the lawyers the other day was he would do what Judge Kaplan did in federal court in the E. Jean Carroll trial and basically have people raise their hands and say, anyone here feel they can't be fair and impartial to Donald Trump? And if they raise their hands, they would get excused.
You'll have to tell us, Patty, how much raising of hands there is at that point. Thanks so much. That's Bloomberg legal reporter Patricia Hurtado. Up next, Sam Bankman-Fried's sentencing is coming up. I'm June Grosso, and you're listening to Bloomberg.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
Sam Bankman-Fried, remember him? His spectacular fall from grace in trial for masterminding a multi-billion dollar fraud kept him in the headlines for months. But since his conviction last November, things have been quiet for SBF, at least in the media. But behind the scenes, he's been preparing for his sentencing and appeal, most notably by changing lawyers. His family and friends have flooded the judge who'll sentence him next month with pleas for leniency, arguing that his public image as a, quote, freak with evil intentions was dead wrong. His lawyers are asking he be given no more than 6.5 years in prison, quite a contrast to the 100 years the probation department has suggested. Joining me is Bloomberg legal reporter Chris Domesh. What is the maximum he's facing? How long could the judge sentence him to?
So obviously, there are a lot of factors at play here, given the seriousness of his conduct and the number of charges he was convicted of. But I talked to a lot of defense attorneys about this, and he's going to get probably at least a decade in prison, which is, you know, a lot of time for a person of his age, but it's kind of reasonable given what the sentencing guidelines call for him to serve, which is a lot of time, which is a life sentence, essentially, given the size of the loss in the case. But, you know, anybody who follows the criminal justice system in America, especially the federal system knows that white collar sentences, which are driven by monetary losses, are often the proposed sentences under the guidelines are really, they're draconian is the word. So it's very unlikely he would serve, you know, 25 years is probably a little bit on the higher end. See what the government says when they submit their submission later this month. But the judge himself, in this case, Lewis Kaplan, has issued skepticism about the guidelines in the past, especially in white collar cases where the loss amount is very high. And if you look back at some of the cases that he sentenced, he doesn't tend to throw the book at people. He's obviously a tough judge. You know, he gave the SDS defense team a hard time during the trial, but he seems to be sympathetic to the argument, very least, that throwing him in prison for the rest of his life is really not going to do society or him any justice.
So the probation office recommended a sentence of 100 years. What did they base that on?
So the majority of that is based on the monetary loss, which is, you know, the estimates vary, but it's probably at least $8 billion, probably upwards of 10. SBF attorneys argue that really the victims here are going to be made whole by the bankruptcy case and that they're not really going to be victims and that he shouldn't really have to pay restitution. They made a kind of similar argument in the Trevor Milton case with the Nikola founder who was convicted of fraud in his sentencing, saying that Nikola paid a lot of money to the SEC and to settle shareholder lawsuits to resolve the case.
He's gotten a new attorney, Mark Mukasey.
Yep, Mark Mukasey, very well known in the Southern District of New York. His father's former U.S. attorney. He's a former federal prosecutor in the Southern District. He's represented many a white-collar criminal. He's well known to the bar.
So his lawyers are arguing that he should serve no more than 6.5 years in prison. That's on the very, very low end, isn't it?
Yes. They couldn't have really logically argued for less, probably. Practically, that really probably wouldn't have worked with this judge. So they're going to take their shots where they can on the lower end. And, you know, their arguments are kind of similar to what a lot of people are saying, is that throwing him in prison for the rest of his life doesn't really serve the purposes of justice, especially for somebody who, you know, despite the fact that he's a convicted felon, arguably has a lot to give in terms of, you know, his contribution to society. And Mark Mukasey and others have made the comparison to Michael Milken, who, you know, was very young when he was convicted and managed to build up a life of philanthropy, which is really what SBF, and that's what they talk about in these letters, that he is devoted to philanthropy. That's the whole driving force of his life.
Yeah, the quote that you talked about is, "The genius of both men is undeniable. Their contributions were vast. Their wealth and fame were unplanned, their means and methods were questioned by prosecutors, and their downfall was swift and tragic." Sounds a little poetic.
Yeah, I mean, that's Mark Mukasey. His sentencing submissions are pretty poetic, I would say, and are passionate. He's a passionate advocate for his clients, and that's a kind of a hallmark of his sentencing submission.
Now, are they saying that SBF is autistic?
He has medication. There's a lot of letters that were submitted along with this. It doesn't seem to really directly say that he's autistic, but, you know, it implies that.
There were letters about his social awkwardness and inability to read social cues, and that might have led to see his responses after the implosion of FTX as uncaring and dispassionate. And they're also saying that prison will be especially harmful for him because of that.
Yeah, 100%. They definitely argue that some of the social awkwardness that he has and some of the social cues he misses lead people to believe that he's not emotional or not caring, and that instead that's just the way he deals with, you know, his social environment and always has. There's more than 24 letters here from friends, family, his mom, his dad, but also from people who don't even know him, you know, concerned that throwing him in prison kind of ignores the challenges for people like him.
And also a fellow inmate submitted a letter?
Yes, fellow inmate, a former New York City police officer who said he had a bunk right next to him and said, you know, they became pretty good friends and that he believed that Sam is just the kind of person that should not be in prison and that it would not serve any purpose at all.
And his mom wrote, was his mom's letter the most emotional of them?
I would definitely say so. His father's letter was pretty much to the point and very direct. It was only a couple of pages. His mother's letter, it was about 6 pages long, was very passionate, even being a law professor and attorney herself, you know, addressed the judge as his mother. She took aim at the media, for sure. She said that, really, he's a very misunderstood person. He was empathetic from the time he was a young child, almost to his own detriment. And what a lot of the letters talk about, which I found interesting, is his vegetarianism, which he loved steak and fries, his mother said, and his brother, but he gave them up at an early age out of an ethical responsibility to animals. He wasn't some animal lover, they said. This was just something he felt he needed to do. And they felt that that demonstrated the kind of devotion to philanthropy and ethical causes that he kind of had in his life.
His lawyers recommended, this surprised me, that he not be ordered to pay restitution or forfeit any assets. Why so?
Yeah, so they're basically saying that the victims of this from the FTX investors will be made whole through the bankruptcy proceeding, and that there's no real actual losses to them. It's a pretty interesting argument. And like I said, they kind of made this argument in the Trevor Milton case as well, that Nicola paid a lot of money to settle those cases and to resolve, you know, with the SEC, some of the allegations that were at the heart of that case. So therefore, he shouldn't be on the hook, is what they say. Same here with Sam Bankman-Fried.
And Sam Bankman-Fried, he was involved in charitable endeavors, wasn't he?
Yes, indeed. I mean, that's definitely a hallmark of his life. And I mean, that's part of also the case is that, you know, he would funnel FTX customer funds into political donations, mm-hmm. into charitable donations, into speculative investments. So it was all kind of mixed up in the same bucket.
I'm curious as to whether the lawyers that you spoke to thought that, you know, as you mentioned, there was this, I don't know if we could say antagonistic relationship between Judge Kaplan and Bankman-Fried, where Bankman-Fried disobeyed his orders, and so he ordered him to go to jail before trial despite this enormous bail package. And then he made him testify for 3 hours outside the presence of the jury before he could testify. I mean, does any of that end up finding its way into a sentence?
Well, it definitely could. He definitely could find that he perjured himself on the stand during his testimony, which he implied that, you know, happened, and that he strongly would take that into account. I mean, look, they brought in new counsel, so you can read into that what you will. Some of the lawyers I spoke to say, you know, sometimes that's just a good thing to have, like, a fresh set of eyes. He has another lawyer who is also working with me, Casey. He's going to work on the appeal. So they definitely use the sentencing to kind of turn an eye towards the appeal. And, you know, the implication that there wasn't really a lot of intent here to do wrong. So it's hard to say whether or not the antagonistic relationship between the judge and SBF's former legal team will come into play in the sentencing, but that's certainly one of the reasons you get a new set of lawyers for that part of the proceeding.
And where does the appeal stand?
We don't really know. They have to have the sentencing first, which is on March 28th, and then they would proceed once the judgment is issued. There's another question involved as to whether or not he would get a discount of any sort for his time spent in the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn, which is a notoriously bleak jail, been there since August. So certainly get time served of some sort. Whether or not the judge gives that extra weight, hard to tell. And it's also hard to tell whether or not the judge would order him immediately to go to prison, you know, like designate him to a prison and have him go there while the appeal is pending, or whether he has him sit in Brooklyn. I mean, these are all questions that have to be answered at the sentencing.
Is it the judge or the prison system that decides whether he's placed in a medium or high security prison or low security?
It's entirely up to the Bureau of Prisons as to where he goes and where he serves his sentence. The judge can make a recommendation, and unless we'll certainly do so on the recommendations of counsel, I would guess probably somewhere in California. But that's all up to the Bureau of Prisons. And like I said, the judge would have to order him into custody of the Bureau of Prisons after the sentencing proceeding. I mean, he is already in custody technically because he's in jail, but there's a matter of the bureaucracy.
And how do federal prison sentences work as far as getting any credits for time served or good behavior?
There's no parole, but you can get credit for good behavior, basically. I think it's 1 year for every 10 years or so. I don't know if that's exact, but, you know, if he would get, say, a 25-year sentence, he'd serve less than 20 on good behavior.
That is a lot of time. He does have time, though. He is only 31 years old. Thanks so much, Chris. That's Bloomberg legal reporter Chris Domesh. Coming up next on the Bloomberg Law Show, how the anti-tax movement hijacked America. It originated as a fringe movement, but evolved into a mainstream political force. I'm June Grasso, and you're listening to Bloomberg.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
How much do you know about the anti-tax movement in America? It originated as a fringe movement and developed into a mainstream political force that's growing strong and growing the national debt. Columbia Law School's Michael Gratz has written about it in his new book, entitled The Power to Destroy, How the Anti-Tax Movement Hijacked America. And he joins me now. We've all heard about the civil rights movement, the women's rights movement, not so much the anti-tax movement. So how would you describe it?
Well, on the first page of my book, I describe the anti-tax movement as the most important, successful, and overlooked social and political movement of the past half century. Like you, when I ask people to name the most important social and political movements of the time, they answer the civil rights movement, the women's movement, sometime the LGBTQ movement, the Christian evangelical movement, and recently the MAGA movement, but no one has ever mentioned the anti-tax movement.
Why do you think that is?
Well, you know, it's about taxes, and people don't like to talk about taxes, and they don't like to think about taxes. And it's managed to be done largely with support from elites, but also a lot of popular support. I remember when I looked at polling data about the repeal of the estate tax in 2001, 40% of the people who answered the questions said that they expected to be in the top 1% when they died. And 60% of the people supported repeal of the tax, opposed the tax. That's hardly surprising, I suppose. If you ask American public if they'd like to repeal any tax, you'd get about 60% who would say yes, if not more.
And resistance to taxes, can we go back to the Boston Tea Party? I don't know. You start in your book in 1978 with California's Prop 13. Tell us how that got the ball rolling.
Well, I think the 70s were a prime time for an anti-government, anti-tax movement. We had experienced a very rapid inflation, along with high unemployment, something that Keynesian economics had said could not happen together. They were known as stagflation at the time. The civil rights movement was very much on people's mind, particularly in California, where the Supreme Court in California had said that property tax differences in school finance could not be more than $100 per student, and that they needed to be made much more equal. So the public in California thought they were paying property taxes for other people's children to go to school. And many of those other people were not only black, but also Latino because of immigration into California at that time from the southern border. And so you had a perfect storm for an anti-tax movement. It was led by a very interesting fellow. I mean, one of the things that I really do spend time in my book on are small biographies, if you will, of people who were crucial in moving the anti-tax movement forward. And here, Howard Jarvis, who had been a Republican operative and had unsuccessfully supported other tax limitation movements in California before this, including one a few years earlier that had been pushed by Ronald Reagan to limit the income tax. Howard Jarvis became the face of the Proposition 13 movement, and he really emphasized that we should not be paying taxes for things for, quote, them. And he made it clear by them he meant welfare and other expenditures for African Americans and Latinos particularly. But he was very successful. And the anti-tax movement, like all social movements, was motivated by a combination of ideology and self-interest. And in California, housing prices had really begun to inflate dramatically. And the rise in housing prices wasn't producing any nicer housing for anybody. All it was doing was producing greater property taxes. And there had been a lot of corruption. There were three property tax assessors who had actually been convicted of crimes in California shortly before the proposition passed. And so you had corrupt property tax assessors, and you had people, particularly the elderly, who were finding themselves really in a cash crunch to pay their property tax bills. And so self-interest was an important component, Proposition 13, but it took on a new life of its own. And recently, California just rejected an increase in property taxes on commercial property, which also benefited from the Proposition 13 tax cuts, benefited greatly, I should add.
How did Christian evangelicals become part of the anti-tax movement?
Well, this is a really important and interesting and really largely unknown story. In 1971, the IRS was confronted with a case that had been brought in Mississippi that said that it was a violation of law to provide tax-exempt status and allow charitable contribution deductions for private segregated schools. The ruling applied only to Mississippi, but the IRS was in what the commissioner called a pickle, because they didn't want to have one rule for Mississippi and a different rule for everybody else. And until that point, they had allowed tax exemptions and charitable deductions for segregated schools. But the commissioner, with the support of President Nixon, ultimately issued a rule that said that if you were a segregated private school, you were no longer eligible for these tax benefits, which had been the lifeblood, actually, along with some grants from the states, of private segregation academies, as they were called. These private schools were limited to whites, and they had arisen in response to Brown v. Board of Education, which was accompanied by massive resistance to desegregation in the South. A couple of Republican operatives, Paul Weyrich and Richard Viguerie, both of whom were anti-tax Catholics, but important in the Republican Party, and the two of them convinced Jerry Falwell Sr., an important evangelical minister from North Carolina, to create what he then named the Moral Majority. And the impetus for that was a 1978 ruling by Jimmy Carter's Commissioner of Internal Revenue that basically said that not only did you have to say that you were not a segregated school, but you actually had to have minority students. And that created a major outcry among the Christian evangelicals and produced an anti-IRS element in the anti-tax movement.
I mean, it seems like that continues even today.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen congressional Republicans, for example, basically saying they want to repeal the funding that was voted for in 2022 to allow the IRS to enforce the existing tax law, even though the IRS claims that for every dollar of additional funding, it will get $12 in additional revenue and has committed itself not to increase audits on people except those above $400,000 of income. But none of that seems to matter. That is, the anti-IRS movement and the anti-tax movement are bound together. And as a result of the denial of these tax deductions, the Christian evangelicals entered politics in an anti-IRS fashion, anti-tax fashion, and became a very important part of Ronald Reagan's efforts to become president, and have been part of that since. Reagan basically said that he was going to overrule the IRS and withdraw the denial of tax exemptions for Christian evangelical schools. But ultimately, the Supreme Court had to hear a case, and they ruled that allowing those deductions and exemptions was illegal, violated the tax law.
The national debt is over $34 trillion. So how do we lose our sense of fiscal responsibility in favor of tax cuts and more tax cuts?
Well, I think that that happened after the Reagan administration. Ronald Reagan, this is a very little known fact, but Ronald Reagan essentially tripled the federal debt. It went from under $1 trillion when he became president to $2.7 trillion when he left office. And therefore, he created more federal debt during his time in office than all of the presidents before him. This was due not only to his tax cuts, but also to increases in spending, particularly defense spending, which he was very much in favor of. And that meant that his successor, George Herbert Walker Bush, who faced a piece of legislation that we've now all forgotten, known as Graham-Rudman-Hollings, which required automatic cuts in spending that would produce a balanced budget. When George Herbert Walker Bush came into office, those cuts were going to be huge, and they were unacceptable to both Republicans and Democrats. And the first president, Bush, had said when he accepted the nomination for president, read my lips, no new taxes. And then in 1990, he agreed to a budget deal that raised taxes, and many people have claimed that that was at least partially responsible for him losing the election of 1992 to Bill Clinton. And then Bill Clinton, who had run for office on a tax cut platform, decided that because of deficits, he had to raise taxes. And what happened is that as a result of these two pieces of legislation and very robust economic growth in the latter part of the 1990s, when George W. Bush came into office in 2001, the budget deficits had disappeared. We were in surplus, and the Congressional Budget Office was promising that we would have surpluses for at least a decade and perhaps longer, and begin to pay off the federal debt. And George W. Bush proposed a massive tax cut in 2001, and it was enacted faster than Reagan got his tax cuts. And then 9/11 happened, and we entered into a war on terror that cost well over $6 trillion. And George W. Bush also added a prescription drug benefit to Medicare. And the war on terror was the first war in American history that was not paid for with taxes, at least in part. And the prescription drug benefit was the first new entitlement that was not paid for by any new or dedicated taxes. And as a result, we started accumulating very large deficits, and the debt started growing. And the Republicans, I think, having seen what happened to George Herbert Walker Bush, were not going to raise taxes. And the Democrats abetted the Republicans in 2001 in reducing taxes. And then when Obama became president, he essentially extended 90% of Bush's tax cuts. And then he agreed that he would only raise taxes on people over $400,000 of income, which, as you know, became Joe Biden's electoral promise and the promise that he has stuck to. So I think it's a 21st century story where both the Republicans and the Democrats have decided they don't want to raise taxes. The Republicans don't want to raise taxes on anyone. And the Democrats refuse to raise taxes on anyone but the top 2%. So they don't want to raise taxes on 98% of anyone. And in my view, this is not a way that you can sustain a government.
Thanks for joining me. That's Columbia Law School's Michael Gratz. His book is entitled The Power to Destroy, How the Anti-Tax Movement Hijacked America. And that's it for this edition of the Bloomberg Law Show. I'm June Grosso. Stay with us. Today's top stories and global business headlines are coming up right now.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.